As long as I can remember, Christmas has always had a magical charm that makes me tingle with excitement from the moment of realization that the wonderful season is on its way. It usually begins on an early December morning when I step out the back door on my way to the barn or garden, when something in the air, a fresh smell from a crisp breeze or a change in the tinkle of a frosty wind chime, seems to say, "It's coming." From then on, my days and nights are filled with thoughts of Christmas to come and the ones I've had. I've always believed in Santa Claus. He's been a part of my whole life. As a toddler, my imagination was fired by constant readings of A Visit from St. Nicholas. And it never occurred to me to wonder how this fat little man could possibly get down our crooked stovepipes, since we had no fireplace. He always appeared at Christmas concerts, at both school and church, with treats for us kids. Even when times were tough, a package of candy or a small toy was under the tree, done up in a different kind of wrapping paper that could only have come from the North Pole. Usually, when you live on a mixed farm, you can count on a few dollars from at least one source, even if other crops or pursuits fail. But the fall of 1944, in this area, at least on our farm, found our family approaching Christmas with no ready cash. Oh, we had enough to eat, and we certainly could count on a plump turkey or chicken for the festive dinner, and of course we had our own Christmas tree. It was just there was no money for the extras. Despite this, my father told my mother to go ahead and buy what she needed, since the friendly merchants in Trenton would give us credit until after the holidays. Our ace in the hole was the woodlot. As soon as we got a few inches of snow, we would go into the woods and cut enough firewood to sell and pay off any debts incurred. A week before Christmas, the snow started. Big, fat flakes that just kept piling up until the fence tops disappeared. 2 days before Christmas, the snowplow came down our dead-end road and turned around in the barnyard. It was a large wooden V, loaded with boulders, and was pulled by a four-horse team. The driver gave the horses a rest while he stomped the snow off his boots and came into the kitchen for a cup of hot coffee. "They've got it a lot worse back around Sterling," he said. "More wind there. Some drifts over 8 feet high. A few farms have been snowed in all week. By the way, are you selling any wood this year? Sam Barton told me to ask you if I saw you. He's right out. Looks like he might have a pretty cold Christmas." Sam Barton lived on the 9th concession with his wife and 4 children. He worked the old Homer place on shares and often bought a few cords of wood from us, usually later on in the new year. "We haven't started cutting yet," my father answered. "It would be too green to burn this year if we did. I could sell him a couple of cords out of our own pile in the woodshed to get him by for a while. Can we get into his place with a truck?" Yep, should be all right. I plowed his lane yesterday." "You better get it back there tomorrow, though. If this snow keeps up, there's no telling how long you'll have." And so it was on the afternoon before Christmas. My older brother Bert and I piled 2 stacks of dry split wood, each 8 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet, onto the stake body of the old Fargo truck and started out through the still falling snow for the 10-mile trip to the Barton place. The truck's heater never worked well, but we were bundled up warmly and the cab was small enough that body heat was sufficient. Bert played a mean harmonica and seldom went anywhere without it. And while my singing voice left a lot to be desired, I knew all the words to most songs. And as we made our way slowly through the thickening snow, we butchered every tune on the current hit parade and assaulted every Christmas carol that came to mind. It was almost 5, and we had turned on the Fargo's one good headlight by the time we spotted the Barton mailbox and drove up the snow-filled ruts of his lane. Sam and his wife, as well as the 4 noisy youngsters, made us feel like the relief of Dunkirk as they greeted us warmly and began to unload our precious cargo. When we finished, Sam asked Bert how much he owed. My brother said, "Same as last year. Dad said not to charge any more just because it's dry. That's $12 a cord and $1 for gas." I was thinking $25 would certainly help Mum pay off what she owed for Christmas presents when I heard Sam say, "Well, to tell you the truth, I'm a little short this year. All I can spare is $20. Bert hesitated. Mrs. Barton looked embarrassed and hopeful at the same time as she said, "Let me give you a nice capon. It's already dressed and ready for the oven. My chickens were the only thing we had any luck with this year. That'll be just fine, ma'am, said Bert. I waited until we were out of the driveway and turned toward home before I said, Dad's going to be some mad that you're short $5, and the last thing in the world we need is a chicken. What was I supposed to do? Asked Bert. Put the wood back in the truck? The snow was still falling in earnest, and a cold east wind had started piling drifts diagonally across the road. The truck, now without its weighty ballast, was skidding dangerously as the wheels carved new tracks in the pale glow of our single headlight. The windshield and windows were becoming thick with frost, and we took turns scraping clear a small peephole on the driver's side. It was at the corner of the fifth concession, still about 5 miles from home, when we went off the road. The back wheel swerved over the edge of a hidden culvert, and we slid silently and deeply into the snow-filled ditch. There was no point in racing the engine, and pushing was out of the question. We had to get help. The Creighton place is a little over a mile west, said Bert. He'll have a tractor to pull us out. You better come with me. It'll be warmer walking than sitting in the cab. We had only trudged about 100 yards through the storm, and I was thinking what a cold, miserable Christmas Eve it had turned into, when we saw a faint light coming from the window of a small house off to the side of the road. Who lives there? I shouted over the wind. I don't know, answered Bert, stopping and peering through the trees that lined the front yard. I think it used to be an old tenant house, but somebody has fixed it up. Let's give it a try. We were just about to knock on the door when Bert said, Look. Through the curtainless window, I saw the strangest sight I had ever seen in my 14 years, and one I recall clearly even now, many Christmas Eves since. An old man, bald except for a gray fringe over his ears, wearing faded red long johns, was dancing spryly around the room. But he was dancing with a dog. A handsome, well-groomed collie had both front paws planted firmly on the man's shoulders and was awkwardly but purposefully striding back and forth. We could hear the music then and saw a wind-up phonograph in the corner of the room with a large flat disc revolving. Bert and I looked at each other, then back down the road where the truck was fast becoming invisible, and finally knocked on the door. We heard the music stop, and slippered feet shuffle to the door. It was opened wide, and we felt the warmth of a roaring wood fire hit us as the man beckoned us quickly inside. Our name is Bonesteel, Bert said. Our truck has slid into the ditch at the corner. I was wondering if you had a tractor I could borrow to pull it out. Sure have, young feller. Got an Ellis Chalmers in the shed behind the house should do the trick. Take off those coats and sit for a minute first. You must be frozen. Don't worry about your boots. As he motioned us to a slip-covered hobo couch to one side of the fireplace, I took off my coat and glanced around the room. It was small but neat. In the center was a kitchen table and two curved back chairs. A rocking chair was pulled up near the fire. A large kitchen cupboard dominated the far wall, and the other three were hung with framed calendar prints of mountain ranges, seascapes, and floral arrangements. "How about a hot drink?" he asked. Without waiting for an answer, he took an earthen jug and some glass tumblers from the cupboard and put them on the table. Grabbing the poker from the hook over the fireplace, he pushed it deep into the red coals below the burning logs. He turned and smiled at us. "Wasn't expecting company. Not many people stop in here. My own fault, I guess. Rose and I never made many friends out here. Oh, well, it's too late now." He stood with one hand on the poker and stared at a small photograph over the mantel. It showed a laughing woman with thick, long hair, head thrown back, eyes bright and full of humor. "We moved here over 3 years ago from the Maritimes when I retired from the shipyard. Always wanted to get a small farm. Rose had a real green thumb, grew vegetables. Didn't make much, but we were sure happy." The end of the poker was glowing red now. He removed it slowly and plunged it into the jug on the table. A hiss of steam erupted and filled the room with the smell of apple cider. He poured us each a glassful and took his to the rocking chair. The first swallow of the warm liquid seemed to bounce off my empty stomach and brought tears to my eyes. I felt little tingles in my brain, and I realized it certainly wasn't this year's crop. I glanced sideways at Bert and saw him smiling appreciatively. He was not the stranger I was to hard cider. The old man finished his drink in one long, thirsty gulp and absently poured himself another. He poked the fire needlessly. "She died. Died 2 years ago. Just like that." He snapped his fingers, but no sound came. "Not a day goes by, but I miss her. Like an ache it is. Sure miss her at Christmas. It was a special time for us. Didn't pay much attention to the religion part of it, but the love part was sure there. Maybe it's the same. I don't know. We'd make presents for each other, decorate the place with some crepe paper, and always had a roast goose or chicken. I can make a real good stuffing. I got good memories. My minister came by after and said not to worry because Rose wasn't dead. She was living on in heaven. I guess he meant well. I know Rose is dead. And the only place she lives on is in my memories. Maybe that's what heaven is. Memories." A log fell in the fire and sent a shower of sparks up the chimney. This seemed to rouse him from his reverie, and he noticed both his glass and Bert's were empty. I was still taking small sips from mine and thinking the warm room was making me woozy. "There's plenty more," he said. "Thanks, but I better get the truck out," answered Bert. Then with a glance at the old man, he said to me, "You stay here and keep warm. I can yank it out by myself." "Be careful of the crank. It kicks sometimes," the old man said as Bert buttoned his coat and went out the door. With his glass refilled, he sat down by the fire and in a minute continued talking. His dog yawned and stretched closer to the fire. "She was an English girl. Met her on Christmas Eve at a dance in Liverpool during the last war. I couldn't dance worth a hoot, but she showed me how. Would you mind putting that music back on?" I went over to the phonograph and gave the handle a couple of turns, then dropped the arm over the edge of the record. The music started as I returned to the couch. "That piece is called Greensleeves. It's an English tune. We danced to it that first night. It's a waltz, you know. Rose taught me how to make a box pattern with my feet. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. We laughed so much. We got married while I was still in the Navy. Then after the war, we came to Canada, got off the boat in Halifax, and decided to stay there. Lots of good years. Never had kids. Didn't seem to matter. Had each other." The music stopped, and the needle made a scraping sound in the last groove. He started to sing in a low, halting voice. "Alas, my love, ye do me wrong to cast me off discourteously. And I have loved you so long, delighting in your company." I went over to the machine, lifted the arm, and turned off the turntable. "I heard they made a Christmas carol out of that piece," he said. "Makes sense. It's always been a Christmas song to me." He was humming now and staring into the fire. I heard the tractor come up beside the house and sputter to a stop in the shed. Bert came through the door with a blast of cold air. The old man didn't even look up. I put on my coat. "Thank you very much," my brother said. "We really appreciate your help." There was no reply from the figure who rocked and hummed by the fire. Bert took from under his mackinaw the fat capon and set it on the table beside the cider crock. "Goodbye," we both said as we backed out the door. The dog thumped his tail twice on the floor in acknowledgement. The snow was tapering off, and by the time we got to the second concession, had stopped completely. Neither of us spoke on this final leg of our journey, and as we started down our own dead-end road, the moon broke through and shot blue shadows over the snowdrifts. I could see the lights ablaze from every window of our farmhouse as we drew near, and I thought of Christmas Day, just a couple of hours away. With the snowfall ended, my other brothers and sisters and my aunts and uncles would be able to come. There would be laughter and games and shouts of joy as we opened our almost-paid-for presents. Loved ones, together. As we turned up the lane towards the yellow lamplight spilling over the snow, Bert had his harmonica out again, He was softly playing, "What Child Is This?"